Welcome to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability. Your hosts are Bill Reed and John Becker, co-authors of the Integrative Design Guide to Green Building. This program will help you take sustainability to the next level. Here are your hosts, Bill Reed and John Becker.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to Building Deeper Green with John Becker and
Bill Reed.
So, last time, we talked quite a bit with, you might recall, Dr. Gerald Wilhelm about the role of humans, and in fact that humans are nature, not separate from nature. So today we want to move on and begin talking about each of the four key subsystems that we outlined, and I think, Bill, was that our first episode perhaps?
Yep, the key subsystems being habitat, water, energy, and materials. And since we're talking about sustainability, we ultimately have to talk about life and sustaining life, which is why we are really emphasizing, and you might think we're overemphasizing, the idea of living systems and healthy habitat. But it's so different for us as a culture that we feel it is really worth the emphasis, because we will never achieve a sustainable condition until the living systems that support, give us clean air, clean water, healthy soil to grow food, are taken care of and actually regenerated, restored. So without that basis, literally we need to ground the practice of sustainability in the understanding of habitat. Now going further is that habitat is just not out there. As we discussed in the last episode...
Hold on, Bill, just a sec. What we're trying to do today is focus this episode on habitat. So the next four episodes will each focus on one of the four key subsystems, habitat, water, energy, and materials. So hence,
good.
Bill is introducing us to what we mean when we say habitat. So what is habitat?
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about it last time, that habitat is not out there, that nature is not in a park, or nature is not in the boulevard, or the street trees between the boulevards. Nature is everywhere, and that leads us to the point that humans are nature. And when we talk about habitat, we're being very literal that humans and the trees and the animals and the microbes and the soil and the marine life are all part of a habitat system.
So in other words, when we design our buildings, and other biotic systems.
What's that?
So in other words, it's human, earth, and other biotic systems.
Right, right. Yeah, so we don't say humans and nature, although we have a tendency to certainly do that. So when we talk about habitat for humans... just an example of how we're affected and live by these rhythms that we've evolved in. And whether you believe in evolution or not, we certainly can't argue that we are associated directly with the living systems and rhythms of life.
Well, I mean, people have very different theological beliefs about the Earth, and certainly don't want to violate any of those. But if we take what science now calls the age of the Earth and understand it as 4.5 billion years old or somewhere thereabout, and compress that to a week, humans show up. Actually, life shows up Thursday afternoon, but humans don't show up till about 6 seconds to midnight. Well, we didn't start burning fossil fuels, as we talked about, until a 40th of a second to midnight, and we didn't have electric light until a 60th of a second to midnight, when Thomas Edison first put the electric light bulb out in the marketplace in 1879. So, in short, what that means is, again, as Bill said, whether you believe in evolution or not, between 6 seconds to midnight and a 60th of a second to midnight, we had no other light than that which is provided by the sun. Hence, when we start looking at daylight in our indoor environments, we can see that it's directly tied to the outdoor environment, and hence so is human behavior.
Our indoor habitat.
Our indoor habitat. That's even better.
So, for instance, let's talk about lighting for a second.
Is that habitat is both indoor and outdoor, and lighting is just one component of it. What else do we have there, Bill?
Well, I just wanted to, I think lighting's kind of interesting just to show how we're connected with life out there. You know how a lot of people dislike fluorescent lights?
Yeah, why?
And, well, because, well, they're fine during the day because it mimics the brightness of the sun. When you look up at the sun at noon, it's a blue-white light, which is very close to what fluorescent lighting provides. But in the evening, it seems very harsh to us. And that's why a lot of people resonate to incandescent
lights, fluorescent
light, actually closer to fire. What, John?
So saying a fluorescent light looks harsh to us.
Oh, yeah, the fluorescent lights look harsh to us, but the incandescent lights actually have an orange glow. And really what we're responding to is that the color of the sun in the morning and the evening is actually orange. It's not blue-white. So the light that we see is actually a much warmer light during the evenings and mornings, and incandescent lights are actually more appropriate to our color spectrum adaptation than fluorescence.
All right, so tell me why I hate overhead light.
Oh, that's another interesting thing, and who knows if this is true or not, but it's a speculation that we evolved in the savanna in Africa underneath large trees.
Jerry talked about that in the last episode.
Did we?
Yeah.
Well, I'll repeat it again for a second, just for a second.
No,
so
we
evolved
yeah.
under these trees, and the bright light came from the sides, whereas the overhead canopy was actually dark. And so we actually are much more comfortable with light coming from the side of a room, wall sconces, et cetera, than a ceiling light.
So light being just one component of all of these different issues that we address when we enclose space and put humans in them, because remember, I think it's always important to remember that the reason we create buildings is we want to house humans. So now we're talking about other systems such as air and water, et cetera, and I think essentially if the outdoor habitat is not healthy, we don't stand a chance of making the indoor habitat healthy.
Well, right. Actually, you know, it's when you talk about water, clean water, people say, well, we just send our water to a treatment plant. But we don't. The treatment plants, actually, I don't know if you know this, but our treatment plants don't remove caffeine. They don't remove hormones. I hear some rumor that men are growing breasts in California. I don't know if that's true, but it's kind of a funny thought, just because of all the hormones and estrogen in the system. Antibiotics remain in the water. So when we're actually trying to do it mechanically and through engineering technologies, we're actually not succeeding at doing what nature does. So nature's services are really important.
So we talked about that a little bit last time in terms of these free services and really needing to understand that we're in reciprocal relationship where humans are participating, hence back to our definition of integration. Which you may remember, Bill, to integrate means to make whole. And to make whole, you have
to heal.
Heal those things that are damaged, because whole really means not injured. And the definition of to heal is also to make whole. In essence, then, when we are integrating these systems, we are healing them. Hence, understanding our role as humans in the whole system. So what we want to talk about today with Keith Bowers, and Bill, maybe you want to introduce him in a sec
sure.
here, is at least our relationship with habitat and what Keith has been doing in his career in that regard.
Well, Keith is, I've known Keith for maybe 10 years now. Keith is the founder and president of Biohabitats. It's a large national firm. It's one of the earliest and, I would say, leading firms working on the field of habitat restoration. And Keith is internationally recognized in his work. He's the chair of the Society for Ecological Restoration, and he's worked and managed, designed many over at least 200 ecological restoration projects. So, Keith, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Bill, and thanks, John. I'm glad to be here.
So you just heard us, I think you were tuned in to us just rambling in the beginning here. Any comments, anything that you felt you wanted to say?
I think that definitely habitat and sort of life outside buildings is integral to making sustainability and regenerative design work.
Yeah.
So when you say regenerative design, can you distinguish that for us from, let's say, restoration or conservation?
Or high performance even.
Sure. So we get involved in all three of those types of projects. We get involved in conservation projects where we're looking at trying to conserve certain aspects of a landscape, whether it be habitat or whether it be healthy soils or whether it be other types of enhancements. We also get involved in ecological restoration projects where a certain ecosystem has been degraded or destroyed, and we're asked to come in and help restore that landscape to its values and functions as if it hadn't been destroyed in the past and it was on a certain trajectory going into the future. Then we're being asked more and more to get involved in projects that involve sustainable design. And we really look at sustainability and ask ourselves, do we really want to be sustaining what we have out there now, and can we really afford to do that in terms of the degradation of ecological processes that are going on, or do we want to really be a catalyst for regenerating some of these ecological systems to a point where they're basically beginning to heal themselves and can sustain themselves in the long run, given our current land use patterns and development patterns.
So in some ways, Keith, what I thought I heard you say is that in a way you are equating sustainability with regeneration.
Well, I think sustainability is a part of regeneration. You know, many people, when they think about sustainability, they think about, and I'm sure you've all talked about this, it's about sort of how to be less bad. How to pollute the air less, or how to maybe pollute the water less or use less energy. And when we're talking about regenerative design, we're really talking about taking that many steps further and saying, how can we actually regenerate some of these ecological processes that we have degraded or destroyed over the past?
So in other words, when you're conserving, you're finding something and keeping how it is. When you're restoring, you are repairing it, and when you're regenerating it, you are participating in a coevolution of its health.
Yeah, and I think that's the key there, John. It's participation. It's how can humans participate in an active, engaged, and meaningful way in restoring these ecological processes? Because as you all stated early on, that humans are a part of the environment. They are a part of ecology, and they have to participate, or else we're going to fail. Just stay in the course of how sustainability is being currently defined.
So, Keith, there's so much confusion out there between the terms conservation, less so with conservation, but I want to come back to that too. But between restoration and regeneration,
okay.
And I think we've defined it some. But why is there that confusion out there? Because you hear people using the terms synonymously.
Yeah, I think there's been a growing practice over the past maybe two or three decades on restoration, conservation biology, and restoration ecology. In other words, how can we begin to restore ecosystems or restore landscapes or restore habitats? But really, sort of in the pure science of that, it's been done with little regard, I would say, to human participation. However, you could argue that there are some cultural landscapes that restoration ecologists are looking at restoring, and there, because they're cultural landscapes, people are an integral part of it. But that seems to be missing from our modern-day life. And really, I think in order to restore ecosystems, given the amount of development and urbanization and land disturbance activities that have taken place, that people need, they need to participate, they have to participate in order for...
Oh, Keith, I'm gonna hold that thought. We'll come back to that after the break.
Okay.
Are you a wildfire survivor? Do you need help but don't know where to turn? SoCalHelp.org is a place you can go to get immediate help with food, shelter, important medications, and start getting your life back on track. Get help now with insurance, legal issues, and find professional help like doctors and counselors. You can also connect with other survivors and people who can help. For the answers and support you need to rebuild, visit SoCalHelp.org.
Many designers are adapting their design process. They are developing methods to address the environmental impact of their work. Graphic, industrial, interior, architectural, landscape, identity, and fashion designers share a common experience. By revealing the thought processes of people from a wide range of design disciplines, your understanding of sustainable design strategies will deepen. Join us every Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific, for Design Evolution on the Green Talk Network.
America is facing a skilled workforce shortage. SkillsUSA can help. What is SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA is life-changing.
SkillsUSA is awesome.
SkillsUSA is one of the biggest opportunities life can give you.
SkillsUSA is amazing.
SkillsUSA is motivating.
SkillsUSA specifically prepares you for the workforce.
SkillsUSA empowers students to connect with a network of people, starting with their classmates, to their advisors, to other people in their states. SkillsUSA allows students to connect with business and industry, to manage their education, and to really get a feel of the real world. I'm doing something now that's going to be applicable in the real world, and those skills are going to be useful today in school and in 5 years when I'm working and for the rest of my life.
SkillsUSA champions at work.
On the web at skillsusa.org.
At the Green Talk Network, our experts want to hear your voice. Do you have a question or comment for our hosts? Call us toll-free, 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, folks. We're here with Keith Bowers of Biohabitats. John Becker and Bill Reed are your hosts. So, Keith, we were talking about the differences between restoration and regeneration, and during the break we had a little bit of a conversation around that. You want to dive in, and we can pick up where we, with the audience, once you define it again.
Sure. So, I see regenerative design as really engaging people in the process to sort of restore their sense of place of the landscape in a much more engaged and much more meaningful way than maybe what a sort of purist would think about in terms of ecological restoration. So ecological restoration, we might be out there to restore habitat and restore certain functions or values of that habitat without too much thought about how people are either directly or indirectly engaged in that habitat. Where in regenerative design, it's really about how that habitat is really engaged with people and how people engage that habitat and how they work, how they both work together in a sort of symbiotic way to help or improve the ecosystem.
So in other words, you're working as a whole organism over time. So in other words, you're not really done. Is that what you're saying?
Well, and I do say that, John. In fact, I say that both from a restoration and regenerative standpoint that really when you're out there actually doing the restoration or whether you're participating in regenerative design, actually employing it or putting it in the ground, if you could call it that, you're only about 10 or 15% of the way there. That really having to live with that ecosystem, to evolve with that ecosystem or that habitat is really then participating in that particular environment.
So it's an exchange. It's kind of like what Jerry talked in the last show about learning from those brothers and sisters.
Absolutely. Sure.
Yep. So the nature of regeneration then actually creates a unity, an integration between people and the ecosystem, if you will, as Jerry said, the brothers and sisters out there. So it's a whole system. I just want to actually ground that term, whole system, because there's nothing that's apart from a whole system.
Correct.
Regeneration is actually the practice of becoming whole.
Now, and Bill, I think that's a really good point, but I think I also need to kind of chime in here and say that there are some habitats and there are some ecosystems and there are some species that basically will not survive with human interference.
Good.
And so I think that's where conservation comes into the picture.
Good. And let me just interject here. We need to learn how to recognize that.
We do need that. And I think we do recognize that. I think we need to learn how to set those areas aside in a meaningful way.
Could you give us an example of one or two of those just to help me understand what that means?
Sure, John. In the eastern deciduous forest, there's what's called interior dwelling species, mostly interior dwelling birds that basically they do not mate or they do not survive in areas of forest that are closer than 200 feet to the edge of the forest or aren't a certain amount of size in what we call a patch size in the interior of the forest. Because what happens is...
What was that term? Patch size?
Patch size. So patch is the area of habitat that, in this case, these particular birds need. So a patch could be defined in acres. So So, for instance, in these interior patches, if they diminish less than, say, 200 acres in size, then these interior birds will not nest there or will not survive there. And the reason being is because when you start to get near the edge of forest, the microclimate changes, nutrient cycling changes, the hydrology of the forest changes, and these bird species just don't survive on those edges. And so if we start fragmenting our forest and fragmenting these patches and they become closer to the edge, then we lose those species altogether.
And so those species actually participate then in the movement of nutrients, et cetera, that are making up the hole in that place.
Right. So kind of looking
even all the way out to the edge of the forest, right?
Right.
So then if we're wanting to put a building adjacent to the edge of that forest, this is something we should know.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we try to bring to the table when talking to planners and landscape architects and architects is to kind of take a step back and look at the landscape from a 30,000-foot level and look at these what we call corridors, these almost corridors like you'd think of as a road or a highway. Well, animals and wildlife need corridors as well, uninterrupted corridors, and they need these patches and certain size patches. And if we can sort of lay out that print on the landscape first and recognize that those species really cannot be disturbed, then we go in and develop and alter the landscape around that, then we're really preserving the core, conserving the core of some of these ecological processes in these habitats.
Okay, hence this is why there is a clear role for conservation, obviously. So.
Absolutely. There's very much a need for conservation. But, you know, John, that brings up another point, and that's with climate change. And with our climate changing, it becomes even more imperative that we set aside these corridors and these patches so species, both animals and plants, can begin to migrate or move as climate begins to move.
And evolve as well.
Or evolve, yeah. Now, you know, from an evolution standpoint, that might be, you know, thousands of years, but we need to be able to either directly assist or provide these types of corridors for these animals and for these plants to migrate as the climate and the rainfall patterns do begin to change.
So do developers or design teams hire you to discover where these areas are and what their meaning is to that place?
Yeah, that's right. They do. They hire us, and we work side by side with architects and landscape architects and urban planners to not only look at the landscape from that 30,000-foot level, and that discipline is called landscape ecology, and then you get into conservation biology, but they begin to look at how can you begin to regenerate some of these ecological processes in the same act as either developing or altering the landscape.
So there's a need for people to hold. You know, I think we have a problem. I'll just kind of be pedantic about this point. Is that we have a problem holding both and. You know, we've kind of either or. Well, it's either conservation or it's either restoration or it's either regeneration. And in fact, it's probably all of those.
Yep, that's what I'm getting out of this.
That's sort of my aha moment I had about 5 or 6 years ago when we were doing mostly restoration work and we were asked to do some conservation planning and sustainable design with the Green Building Council, and the LEED program was coming on board. And all of a sudden, I kind of looked up and I saw the convergence of all three of these sort of disciplines coming together, conservation biology, restoration ecology, and sustainability, and thought, you know, that's really where we need to be. And in order to be regenerative, in order to regenerate these ecological processes, we have to have all three of these working in an integrated and simultaneous way.
And be able to know enough to be able to decide which is where and what needs what.
Yeah, and there's always trade-offs, I think. In any project we work on, there's always trade-offs of sort of looking at the macro scale versus the micro scale. But I think, you know, Bill, the other thing that we need to look at is not only from a sort of a geographic or footprint scale-wise, but we need to look at it from a temporal scale as
right.
well. Because, you know, the metabolism of
What scale was that, did you say?
A temporal scale.
Explain that word?
Huh?
What do you mean by temporal scale?
A time scale.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So in terms of decades and centuries and millennia?
And also, John, I think in terms of seasons, in terms of climatic patterns, in terms of mating, in terms of foraging, I mean, all different types of scales that these species or animals or even plants live under, we tend to ignore them in terms of our sort of fast-paced economic and cultural scale.
Both micro and macro temporal scales.
Yep.
Right. Well, John, we just interrupt here. We try to stabilize everything to one condition.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the mechanical view of the world. We need to start we need to become aware of those rhythms again. We've forgotten them.
We have forgotten them. You're right, Bill. Yep. And you know, it's interesting. I've been reading a lot lately about the sort of comparison of the metabolism of nature versus the metabolism of our economy right now, and how our economy is so, so sped up, it's so fast that we're completely losing touch with the metabolism of nature. And soil regeneration and ecological values and functions in terms of if we go back and look at the metabolism of nature and try to then fit in our not only land development activities but our economy and our sort of go back to the way we used to have sort of cultural norms back into the metabolism of nature, then maybe we can realign ourselves and actually fit in from more of a regenerative standpoint.
Well, that brings up the whole idea of local versus global. I think that I would make this, I propose that until we really become part of our communities again, we will probably never experience those rhythms.
And you're exactly right, because, community is a huge, I think, structural sort of benchmark in all wildlife species.
That's part of the whole.
Right?
It's just the community of another guild.
It's a manageable part of the whole. That's what's cool about it. It's not just saying save the world. It's saying work in your community.
That's right. Exactly right. Yep.
One of the things that really interests me about all this is that it is what we're talking about is a mindset shift, and how is that mindset shift applied to our real work? And Keith, there's a project that you guys did just outside of Baltimore a few years back that I know Bill uses and I use all the time as an example of how humans can participate in the health of the place. And do you remember that project? It was for a park outside of Baltimore?
It was actually for it's a stream called Spring Branch, and it flows into Loch Raven Reservoir, which is a drinking reservoir for Baltimore City.
Could you tell us a little bit about that project and what you guys did and what you found and what the results were?
Sure. So the county was concerned about not only stormwater runoff from the neighboring developments, but they were concerned about this stormwater runoff into this creek, and then the creek eroding and causing sedimentation into the drinking water supply. But in the 1950s and 60s, part of the creek was also lined with concrete to minimize any erosion that was taking place, because back then there were no stormwater management regulations, and the creek, like many urban or suburban creeks, had begun to cut down and erode its banks, and there was a lot of erosion taking place. And believe it or not, this stream was considered a trout stream as well in Baltimore County, and that's sort of on the southern edge of some of the trout in the eastern seaboard. So we were asked to come in, and instead of applying a more structural approach to stream stabilization, in other words, instead of putting the stream into more concrete or piping it, we were asked to look at actually restoring the natural meander pattern, a natural cross-section, a natural profile of the stream, and restore the trout habitat in there. So we worked with hydraulic engineers. We worked with fluvial geomorphologists. We worked with aquatic biologists. And
wait, we got to stop you on fluvial geomorphologists.
Yeah, fluvial geomorphologist. I think a lot of people
define that one.
That means
okay. So fluvial is water and the movement of water, right?
Yep.
And geomorphology is really geo is earth and morphology is the shape of the earth. So it's really how water shapes and forms the earth or the landscape. And so fluvial geomorphologists could be studying how rivers and streams shape the landscape. There are some fluvial geomorphologists that study coastal processes. But in this case, we're looking at fluvial geomorphologists that study how rivers sort of behave and how they transport sediment and transport water and interact with their environment.
Okay, that's a good. We'll in the middle of the story here, we got to stop you for a break. let's pick it up after geofluvial morphology when we come back on.
Yeah, I want to find out what you guys did with this stream.
Okay.
What can you tell me about SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA teaches you employability skills. So you know how to deal with people, you have teamwork, your resume is going to look awesome.
Well, it's important to know your technical skills, but not only that, to have soft skills, the skills of learning how to communicate with people.
SkillsUSA champions at work.
On the web at SkillsUSA.org.
Can we recognize our world not as a commodity, but as a sacred creation that will support us best the more creatively we live on it? Green Visions is all about how a spirit of innovation and pleasure can be brought into solving our environmental problems. Join your host, Carolyn North, each week as she talks about what citizens of the world are doing to make a difference. Heal the planet, heal yourself, and have a good time doing it. Tune in to Green Visions with Carolyn North every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Green Talk Network.
Hey, y'all. This is Stephen Cochran. As a country artist, I have traveled around this great country of ours, often meeting our brave men and women in uniform. And as a Marine and veteran of both the Iraq and Afghan conflict, I know how important it is to thank our troops who defend our freedom each and every day. One of the best ways to thank them is to give their children and spouses the gift of education. Scholarships for 2 years, 4 years, and vocational school. This is exactly what a national charity Thanks USA does. Please go to their website, www.thanksusa.org, to make a generous donation to the Thanks USA Scholarship Fund for the families of the troops, and I thank you.
Keep listening to the Green Talk Network for the latest in the sustainability and green movement for all of our futures, today and tomorrow. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back. And we have Keith Bowers as our guest. And Keith was telling us a story about a stream restoration in Baltimore and left off at the definition of geofluvial morphology, which I love to say that those words. So, Keith,
okay,
keep going.
So we had all these different experts working on the project, along with landscape architects and civil engineers. And what we did is we came back to the county with an idea of restoring the natural processes of the stream, but in such a way that they could still handle the stormwater that was coming from the surrounding neighborhoods. And if you can imagine, this is a suburban neighborhood that was built back in the 1960s and maybe early 70s. A very typical suburban, lots of streets, houses on quarter-acre to half-acre lots, all draining to this stream channel.
So, Keith, the stream you found there was what, like an 8-foot-wide, 2-foot-deep concrete trench?
Yeah, so parts of the stream were put in this concrete swale, which you're right, actually is about 8 to 12 feet wide and about 2 to 4 feet deep, almost like a half of a concrete pipe that was placed in the channel. The channel was straightened, so the meanders were taken out of it. And also, stream channels tend to have dips like pools and riffles and other sort of features on the bed of the stream, and all that was smoothed out when the pipes were put in.
What's funny about this from my perspective is that streams are basically elevated groundwater tables. Is that right, Keith?
That's exactly right.
So here you put a concrete trench in that prevents the groundwater from coming up.
Well, not only that, you get some groundwater seeping in from the top and the sides, but you're absolutely right. You prevent the groundwater from coming in, and you prevent any interaction between the microorganisms in the soil below the stream and the aquatic life in the stream, which then tends to basically degrade or kill off all the aquatic life in the stream.
Which means that fresh water, that stream that was previously making fresh water when it was running with controlled water, is now basically a repository for a lot of pollutants.
That's absolutely right. There's a lot of pollutants coming off of these streets and driveways and even rooftops of some of these houses. And instead of being absorbed and and filtered through the plants and the soil, and now they actually just run right down the concrete flume into the reservoir.
Yeah, and it would clog up with debris and stuff too, right? So you'd get certain insect infestations at certain locations?
Yeah, you get a little bit of that, but what the other thing that it does is that along with all streams, there's a floodplain, and that floodplain's critically important in terms of higher flow events during storms that flood out onto the floodplain and saturate the soil and provide unique habitat and provide nutrient sinks and attenuate flood flows. And when you put the stream into a concrete ditch, you basically send all that water downstream without hydrating or without wetting that floodplain.
The photograph that we used to show what you guys did, when I show it to folks, I actually have the two images superimposed on each other. First is the concrete trench, and then the same view showing the stream when you guys were done. And for all intents and purposes, it looks like that stream's been there for a very long time. It looks like a stream that you would find out in the woods.
It does. What we did was we took up all the concrete. We put back in the meander patterns that could handle the flows and the sediment coming downstream. We built back in riffles and pools and habitat substrate for the fish and the aquatic insects. And then we also put back in a channel width or sort of a cross-section of a channel that could then handle those flows and allow the higher flows to go up into the floodplain.
And now really, we've got a solution that is participating to keeping the water clean and healthy, not only downstream but infiltrating into the groundwater table. We've reintroduced habitat that can transfer nutrients both upstream and downstream. We've brought back health to the materials such as the adjacent forest tree roots. And, in fact, all the energy it took to make that concrete no longer will need to be used again because it's not going to deteriorate over time like the concrete trench would. So, in essence, you addressed all four of our key subsystems with this one little solution. So,
yeah, and I think more important, John, is that we engage the neighborhood in doing this. We engage them in the design process. And to give you one small example is that while we recognized that we wanted to replant the riparian area, that area adjacent to the stream channel and part of the floodplain with all native plant species, we met with all the homeowners along the stream and kind of gave them a list of plants, of these native plants, and they actually selected the native plants that they wanted out in their backyard adjacent to the stream so they could, you know, possibly take in some ownership of this project and see something, see how their property could be improved with this project.
Okay, so what does it look like now? How long has it been?
So it's been about 6 or 7 years now since it's in. It's been a resounding success. We've gone back in and we've tested for fish and what we call macroinvertebrates or the aquatic insects in the stream and found that they have rebounded significantly in there. The types of fish and the quantity of fish and macroinvertebrates has skyrocketed. We have people coming up to us now. We had one gentleman who came up to us and said, you know, I didn't even know there was a stream out in my backyard, and now when I go to work every day, I walk out my door and I can hear the stream babbling over the riffles out there and know that, you know, there's a functioning ecosystem, that there's habitat out there where before it was out of sight, out of mind.
Hey, so that's pretty cool. So people are responding.
People are responding, and in fact, we had a couple of ardent people that were not favorable toward the project that thought that maybe the taxpayers' money could be used elsewhere, and were out there watching the construction process, and now they're champions of this method. And in fact, we were just contracted and just completed another mile downstream of this section for Baltimore County because it was such a success.
How long does it take you to do a mile of stream? Sorry, I'm maybe getting a little geeky here, but I'm...
Yeah, you know, Bill, that depends on the size of the stream and construction access and everything else. But, you know, you could easily construct a stream segment in maybe 2 to 3 months.
Yeah. And then how long does it take to actually get a toehold? How long do you have to maintain it before it takes on, it basically self-organizes itself?
Yeah, we found that anywhere from about 1 to 5 years that you've got to do adjustments and maintenance. And one of the things that we are a strong believer in, whether it's conservation or regenerative design or restoration, is adaptive management.
Yeah, so talk about that. That's important.
Yeah, so you know, ecological systems evolve over time, and they are constantly changing. And that I think it would be sort of ludicrous for us.
We try and keep them in stasis.
Yeah, you know, to put something down on a blueprint and say this is how it's going to go in the ground, and this is how it's either going to behave or age over time. It's just not going to happen that way. And we need to be able to adapt to changing conditions out there and have contingency plans that, as these changes occur, whether it's changes in water flow or changes in success, plant community succession or whatever, that we're able to go out there and make tweaks to the system to help it evolve over a period of time.
Yeah, so what pops into my mind is the nature of not only are we adapting, I'm going to go somewhere else and I'm going to come back to this point. You and I have both experienced, Keith, environmentalists basically who have the attitude that what gives us the right to meddle at all with the environment?
Well, what I'm hearing here...
You want to speak to that a bit?
Well, okay, just really fascinating, because what I'm hearing here is that this is evidence that we can actually use the process of development, which we normally think of as a pejorative, in a very positive, healing way.
Well, we can, absolutely, John. And I think, Phil, to get back to your point, I think that, you know, restoration ecology is a relatively new science. It's a new way of looking at things. It hasn't been around that long, where conservation, although you could say is relatively new because it's only been around for about 70 or 80 years, that, you know, there's conservation biologists out there that might say, well, the first and foremost, we need to be protecting what we have before we put any time or money into restoration.
And I think that's pretty, it's hard to argue with that, right?
It is hard to argue with that, but I would suggest that, and I think you're even seeing this change occur. Take the Nature Conservancy, for example. 10 years ago, they were all about, you know, send in your money and we're going to conserve this parcel of land, where now if you look at all their outreach materials, it's getting people engaged in the restoration process and the stewarding of some of these lands versus just pure conservation. Mm-hmm. And I think they realize with things like climate change and invasive species and other disturbances that we need to be doing, even to conserve landscapes, they're not static, and we need to be looking at restoration as a component of that of a wider conservation program.
Okay, so yeah, what I want to try and do here is how does this impact us when we're building? Because If this program is called Building Deeper Green, so for example, that stream that you did, it was dealing with stormwater runoff or rainwater runoff, better term, from some sort of impervious surface construction upstream, correct?
Or drinking water runoff,
correct? Right.
Yeah, drinking water runoff.
Yeah.
Right. So this is maybe a good way to sort of take this forward right after our upcoming break here is. How you see this connecting with building and development and architecture as we are creating buildings.
How do we integrate it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So what would be your initial response to that?
Well, I think that, you know, a building or any kind of land development or disturbance activity has to be integrated into the sort of ecology, biology, life systems that...
Fluvial morphology.
Huh?
And the fluvial morphology.
And the fluvial morphology and the terrestrial morphology, right. That, you know, you've got nutrient cycles, you have energy flows, you have a hydrologic cycle, you have succession, you have disturbance regimes, and all those are critical to maintaining our health and welfare. And a building or a site development needs to be integrated into all those processes. And in fact, I would suggest needs to not only be integrated into those processes, but actually needs to be a catalyst for regenerating.
Yeah, and it actually, and here's the hard thing for a lot of people to get. If we really understand it, we can actually make buildings like acupuncture.
Ooh, wow.
That it's an opportunity to actually energize the system in a way that maybe it hasn't been energized for 150 years.
That's right.
Well, let's come back to that after the break, and
we
can talk about this idea of acupuncture.
Okay, coming back after our break. Thanks all.
Attention swimmers, get out of the water! Everybody, out of the water immediately!
Dude, is that...
It's a pair of thunder thighs. Big ones, too. That mom, who's been swimming a lot with her kids, must have lost them.
Whoa. I heard about this happening once up at Laguna.
Small step number 54. Play with your kids. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to get healthy. Learn more at www.smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Are you thinking green? How do you make your home, family, and life green? Green Today with host Nelson Martinez aims to answer these questions and more. Look to the show as your guide to everything green, from the global movement to what's going on in your neighborhood. We can all do a little something to help our local environments and the planet as a whole by being smarter consumers and using products that are less harmful. Listen for Green Today with Nelson Martinez, Mondays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on the Green Talk Network.
In the great scheme of things, a minute isn't all that much, unless you happen to have a stroke. All of a sudden, those minutes count. Minutes that could mean losing your ability to talk, move, or walk. Which is why, if you can get help in time, your stroke can be treated. The warning signs of a stroke include sudden numbness or weakness of the face. If you experience this, call 911 immediately. Visit strokeassociation.org or call 1-888-4-STROKE today. A public service announcement from the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Thank you for listening to the Green Talk Network. Help to spread the green by involving your family and friends. You're doing your part. Now help them think green. Spread the green. The Green Talk Network.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back. And we left on the idea of buildings as acupuncture in the environment. Keith, you want to take off on that?
Boy, I thought you were going to take off.
Oh, I'll take off.
Oh, by the way, this is both urban acupuncture and non-urban acupuncture, right?
Sure. It's it's interesting that we impact the earth. Now, this is I want you guys to push back on this, but we impact the earth with our buildings, our shelter, with our agricultural systems, our food, and agriculture is actually destroying the earth as much as our buildings and our transportation system. Mm-hmm. I would say those are the three giant ones. Maybe there are others.
Well, and they're all critically connected.
Sure.
Your material needs. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And so if we don't take these opportunities in growing our food and building our shelter and moving ourselves about and using that as opportunities to heal, we never have an opportunity for sustainable design. We will never be sustainable on this planet.
I would agree.
So the idea of the word development, I want to raise this here, and I forget if we've raised this before, John, but the idea of the word develop does actually not mean to occupy the land. The word develop in its true meaning means to add value or to create new potential.
Yeah, in fact, I remember we were looking up the etymology of it, and it comes from a term, de-veil. In other words, lifting
reveal.
The veil, which kind of means discover what that place is all about.
Mm-hmm. And I think we've certainly lost that ability out there. And you know, what is that sense of place? How do we discover the patterns that make that?
It sounds like that's what you guys are doing.
Uh-oh, there's a big concept.
Oh, the patterns?
The patterns.
Yeah, the patterns.
Boy. Keith, you want to hit that a minute? That's going to be a toughie, but you want to try?
I think I'll try, but, you know, so there's all kinds of, I think, sort of direct and indirect patterns that are happening on the landscape in many different sort of spatial scales and temporal scales. And it's really trying to discover how those patterns shape and form and provide sort of process and meaning to a landscape. And many times we're just so quick to go in and develop a piece of property and not understand what those patterns are, what they're telling us, or what they could tell us about the land as it used to be or where it's headed in sort of its evolutionary direction, that we are not able then to fully recognize a lot of these ecological processes or the potential that this land could have.
Okay, so there's another significant word, too, potential.
Discovering the potential of the place.
Yeah, so
this, it's interesting. What we've had a tendency to do is we have a we look at the way these overlay maps that Ian McCarg, a famous landscape architect, author of Design with Nature, developed, looking at overlays of hazards and what we need to conserve. But those hazards, I mean, you know, where a forest is, where a stream is, where a degraded soil system is, and you can map maybe a highway if you can find the holes or the gaps in between these systems we want to save. That's one level of patterning. But a deeper level of patterning is, as you said before, temporal. How do you actually look at the patterns going through time, Keith?
Well, but I think we need both, because without...
We do.
Yeah, right? So it's the same thing as when we were talking about before with products and technologies alone and tools alone being insufficient. Well, those are essentially, those maps are tools. And what you're talking about is a process that helps us discover what the real potential of the place is over time.
Which means evolution.
Evolution.
And evolution happens because you have material and energy and food input that's actually allowing that system to evolve. So, Keith, sorry, I got a little lecture-like there. Do you want to...
No, but, you know, it's interesting. I'm sitting down in South Carolina right now and thinking about the patterns here. And really, one of the biggest patterns that happens here is hurricanes. Mm-hmm. And people that are sort of living in between hurricanes, I mean, it might be 20, 30 years before a major hurricane comes through, doesn't realize how the effect that that has on the vegetation community, which then affects the nutrient cycles, which then affects the energy flows, which then affects wildlife habitat.
And food and buildings and transportation.
And buildings and transportation. And so, you know, just taking one disturbance regime like that, it might happen once a generation or once every half a generation, and it's sort of out of sight, out of mind, and you forget to read the landscape and what the landscape's telling you about that disturbance pattern, then you lose sight of actually, you know, trying to integrate a building into the landscape.
Hmm. So where we need to go with the idea of patterning is that it's an essential aspect of assessing a system, and that we need to, as people, we need to understand the patterns of life there, or we're not going to be able to design to it.
I think you're right, yep. And not only do we need to understand the patterns of life, we need to actually, in some ways, forecast some of the patterns of life, given the changes that are occurring globally.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Keith, you've brought us some really remarkable insights today. We both want to thank you for not only what you've shared with us in the past, but what we discovered with you today. So thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
We'll talk later, Keith.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
So what Keith ended up with there was really powerful, because it showed once again that what we're talking about is, even though we were entering the system through one key subsystem today called habitat, we're really talking about a whole. Right? How many ways did Keith connect habitat to all other key subsystems?
Yeah, everything's connected. So the transportation system, the building system, our activities as humans are connected. That's pretty complex, and that actually begins to actually scare people.
Well, how do you address it then?
Well, we can go back to what Jerry was saying last week. And we were talking about the nature of story and why story is so important. It's interesting that stories are about patterns.
Well,
in fact, what, John?
Keith was talking about understanding the story of the place and the story of the people in the place.
Right, right. So the idea of story is something that we have forgotten in our age of data. We love to talk about data. Just give me the facts, ma'am. But data is only partially sufficient. And have I used the example of who we are versus what we are, John?
I don't think you have.
Maybe it's a good time to talk about that.
Yeah, I think go for it.
So the way we look at landscapes is typically the way we look at, is if we were looking at human beings. And if I described my wife as blonde and 5'10" tall and blue eyes and how she weighed so much and she was wore this kind of dress, that would be what she is. We describe our landscapes that way. We have hydro studies and soil studies and geological studies. That's all data. But really what I want to know my wife, I want to know who she is, not what she is. And we need to know who the landscape is.
Who she is dependent largely on her relationships. What's
That's
her family
right.
like? What's her work environment?
How does she relate to me? How does she relate to her parents? How does she relate to colleagues at work? It's those relationships that actually tell us more about the essence pattern
of that person than the data.
So what I think you're saying then is that for us to do this work, yep, we need the data. Yep, we need those overlay maps, but we also need to deeply engage in the story of the place and the people in the place so that we can truly know it if we are going to participate in its health.
Which is discovered through relationships. And when Jerry Wilhelm was talking about our brothers and sisters, the trees and rocks and soil as actually living entities, that's when we have an opportunity to think differently about our places and to think about them as being as us being in relationship to them and them being in relationship to us.
So the next episode, we'll enter this hole from the standpoint of water, just like we did today with habitat. So just remember, to do different things, we need to do things differently.
To do things differently, we need to think about them differently.
And to think differently, we need to be different.
See you next week.
Thank you for tuning in this week to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. Please join us again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Green Talk Network, and make it a great and greener weekend.